and I are going to record, so y'all go ahead and shut the door.
I'm going to go sit on the front porch and read a book. Oh, but we won't have fun without you.
Welcome to our Vintage Archives collection. For a special treat, we are releasing the inspirational testimony of missionary and former prisoner of war, Darlene Rose, in 5 nice little bite-sized pieces. Here is this week's offering.
I only know this, that from that moment on, that man was my friend. He made me head over the whole camp toward the end after the bombings. I think that's what he was telling those men, because they became very quiet and their heads went down. I didn't know at the time, but these men had been up to the camp and told Mr. Yamaji and the women that I was never to be returned to the camp because I was dying of tuberculosis, they said, not wanting them to know that I was to be beheaded. Mr. Yamaji came back into the cell, and he looked down at me, and he said, "Oh, you are very ill, aren't you?" And I said, "Sir, I am." He said, "I'm going back to the camp now, and I just wanted to know if there was any word you had for the women. Everybody's asking about where you are, what's happened to you." And I said, "Mr. Yamaji, when you go back, would you tell those women that I am all right? And they will understand, and I think, Mr. Yamaji, you will understand. I'm all right, because I'm still trusting in the Lord." He nodded to me, he turned, he walked out of the cell, the door was locked, and as soon as I heard them going, I remembered I hadn't bowed to those Kempeitai men. Oh, the fear that came over me, and I said, "God, please, why didn't you help me to remember? Because just as soon as Mr. Yamaji's gone, that guard's going to come back here, and he's going to get me, and he's going to take me back to the hearing room, and please, God, I don't want to go back there anymore." And then I heard the guard coming, so I stood up, and I said, "Lord, once more, please, help me not to shed any tears." The door opened, and in walked the guard, and he just laid them all out on the floor in front of me. He said, "They're all yours. They're all from Mr. Yamaji. You know what they were, don't you? They were bananas." I don't know how you would feel, but never in my walk with my Lord have I felt such shame before him. And I just pushed him over in the corner. After counting them, there were 92 bananas. And I said, "Lord, I don't have any right to eat those." I said, "Yesterday I was telling you, here they are, 4 people, and that's all. And there's no way you could get a banana in here to me." And I said, "Lord, look what you've done." I said, "It's almost 100-fold. And so sweetly the Lord said to me, "But my child, that's the way I delight to do things, the exceeding abundant above anything you ask or think." Then I wanted to eat them all at once. I knew I didn't dare to, because I knew that I would be eating it off the floor again if I did. And I said, "Lord, I don't have much character, but would you just help me to not eat any more bananas than my body can assimilate at each time?" And one day, I was very ill, and I hardly had the strength to get up off the floor. And I would crawl over, and I would get the bananas. They were black now, and I'd take one, and then 2, and then I would leave it. And I sat there realizing that if they didn't behead me, that I probably would die anyway of starvation. I was that sick. And all of a sudden, I heard the most beautiful singing. It was like an angel chorus. And somebody was singing outside. And it was singing in the Indonesian language, because it's so beautiful there. Oh, how sweet the name of Jesus. It's like a refuge in time of trouble. And my heart just swelled when I heard those words. And I said, "Lord, I'm still under the shadow of your wings. And I climbed up the transom above the door, and I thought, whoever that is out there, I would like to see their face. I would like to hear them singing. And when I got up there and I leaned out and I looked in every direction, there was no one there except a guard and the girl from the desk, and they were talking and laughing. They weren't hearing that singing. And suddenly great awe came over me. I got down off the door. I said, Lord, that was an angel singing, wasn't it? The voice went on. It sang to me until my heart thrilled with his presence. I was telling this to Dr. A.W. Tozer. I don't know if you know him. He was a great man of God. He said to me, girl, did you ever think that that was an angel? I said, yes, I did. There was no one there, and yet that voice was singing to me. One day the Lord began to speak to me from three phrases of a verse that says, who delivered from so great a death? Who delivered and doth deliver, he will yet deliver. And I said, Lord, I know you've delivered me from the law of sin and death. I know that I belong to you. And up to this moment, you have kept me. And he would go right back to the beginning and say, who delivered and doth deliver, he will yet deliver. And I said, God, how could you get me out of this place? And God was trying to make me to know that day when I picked up the last banana and I peeled it, here came the guard and he said, quickly, we're going to take you somewhere else. And when we started out in that car to go back to the camp, we would have had to have turned left, and we didn't. We went right to the Gestapo headquarters. We spoke of it as the Gestapo because it was patterned after the German Gestapo. We went right to the headquarters. We were taken into a room. Miss Kemp and Miss Seeley were told to sign and write out and sign a paper how grateful they were to the Imperial Japanese Army for being so kind to them and for having forgiven them, and because they were going to release them. And Margaret was so shaky she couldn't write, and she turned to me and she said, darling, would you write this for us? Thanks for being so kind to us and for forgiving us. And went on to say that they were grateful to the Imperial Japanese Army for their goodness. And then the two of them had to put their thumbprint on it. And then the man came over to me. They were taken into the other part of the headquarters building. And I was there where the executions took place. He walked up in front of me, the brains of the team, and he held out this big sheaf of papers, all the things that he had written. He went through them. He said I was guilty of having had a radio, that I had been in contact with the Allies. I'd reported on troop movements, that I knew where the Allies were and the Japanese, and that I had been giving all of this information to their enemy. And then he looked at me and he said, you have done those things whereof you're worthy of death, and drew his finger across his throat and grabbed his sword at his side, and he began to pull it out. And while that sword was coming out, my heart was singing, I live for him who died for me. And I said, Lord, that's a strange song when I'm going to die. And just as he was beginning to pull that out of there, I suddenly heard sound of vehicles, of all kinds of vehicles, running up to the front of that building, honking their horns, screeching their brakes, and they ran into the building. It was ceramic tile on the floor. They wore the hijack boots with the leather heels, and they were running back and forth and yelling for this man, and he shoved that back down into the sheath, and then he ran into the headquarters, and they were talking in there at the top of their lungs. And I stood there and waited. Somebody said, why didn't you run away? Where would you run to? There's no place to run. And I stood there quietly waiting for him to come back to finish the execution. And suddenly he came and he grabbed a hold of my arm. He took me out and put me into a car. and soldiers jumped in behind me. He jumped in, and then he put two bottles of wine. He said, when you get back, you give those to Mr. Yamaji. We were going like we were top secret material. I don't know what happened that day. I only know that when we lost all of our men, and others of those godly missionaries died, somehow in the providence of God, he spared me. And I vowed that day for any days that were ever left to me, they were all his. When we got back to the camp and we were just across the moat and go in the gate, that man behind me, who was the brains of this team that had been trying me, he reached up and my arm was just the bone with skin drawn over it. He grabbed my arm, and I was sure he was going to break it. I bit my lip, trying to keep from screaming. It hurt so bad as he twisted it. He said, if you ever tell anybody anything that's happened to you, I'll be back and I will get you. And oh, the fear that came over me, thinking I wasn't free of them. When we got there, I just motioned for someone to come. Please take Miss Kemp and Miss Seeley. They put Miss Kemp in the hospital. She weighed in at 90 pounds. And Miss Seeley was so bad that she was beginning to run away and do terrible things. And so they took her down and put her in a little shed that had bars in front of it so that she couldn't get out. And they locked the door on her. And I started back. Nobody seemed to be even have the courage to come and say, we're glad you're back. And I looked at them, and as soon as I got around the bend so that nobody from the office could see, Ruth Presswood put her arm around me and she took me in. And I saw that her mirror was hanging there, and I looked in it and I said, Ruth, my hair, it was white. She just nodded and the tears started down over her cheeks. When they weighed me, I weighed 60 pounds. I had just left her, and all of a sudden, here came a woman who had been a prostitute for the Japanese. Everybody feared her. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with her. And there she was, and she motioned for me to come out into the little dining area. And here she had a washcloth, and I saw my name embroidered on it. And she said, I was down in prison too, and your Indonesian friend, Visha, was in the cell with me. And she said, I asked her if she wanted to send anything to you. And so she made this for you, and there was my name embroidered on it. And I knew she was trying to trick me. And I remembered the words of that man, if you ever have contact with anybody outside of this camp, I'll get you the next time. And I said, Mrs. Klaus, I am not going to take that. She said, you have to take it. I said, no, I don't have to take that. I'm not going to take that. I said, they told me I could have nothing to do with anybody outside. I said, you're trying to trick me. She was so angry with me. She was absolutely white. And so she was screaming at me. She said, I risked my life, she said, to bring that to you. Mrs. Presswood heard her. She came out, and she said, what's the matter, Darlene? And I started to cry. I said, she's trying to trick me. She brought this. She's trying to make it appear that I had contact with Visha. And Mrs. Presswood reached over and grabbed her arm. She said, if I ever see you near her again, I don't know what I'm going to do to you. And fear came on me, fear that I was going to be taken back again. And days I would go out and I would work, and I'd come home. And I didn't dare to sleep. I was afraid I was going to lose my mind and I would go to the hospital. Margaret Kemp's memory was gone. And I would go down and I asked if I could work with the chickens because I could be near Miss Seeley. And I could hear her in there and I would go up and try to put my hands around hers and talk to her. And then I would turn away and I'd think, God, look at these women, women of such faith. And who am I? I'm the youngest of all of them. And look at these women of such tremendous faith, so broken, Father. And that fear stayed with me. I didn't care to go to sleep at night. And one day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, I worked. And at night, I couldn't sleep. I was afraid to. I was afraid my mind would go while I was sleeping. I would just drop off to sleep, and then I'd wake up. And I was just perspired because of the fear that was on me. And I would sit up, and I'd say, Lord, I've tried to trust you. I've tried in every way I could to be a good soldier for you. And please, Lord, I can't go on any longer. And then I walked out of the barracks one morning, and I said, I have no more strength, Father. I said, I've tried with everything that was within me to reach up to you, and I don't know where you are anymore. And I threw up my arms, and I said, I'm gone. I'm gone. It was like arms went underneath me. And I suddenly began to sing, underneath thee, oh, how precious. You have not to mount on high, but to rest upon his promise in a trustful resting lie. And I saw it. He wanted to teach me, you can't mount up to God. Your own righteousness is like filthy rags, but rest upon your God. For underneath are always and ever the everlasting arms of God. We had had bombings every year, and we dug our own slit trenches to try to be protected in a measure from the shrapnel that came into the camp. And then one day we looked up and we saw planes coming over. And then one of them separated from the other planes, and he came down, and he came right over the camp, and he dropped something. And I looked and I saw a large thing that I didn't know what it was. It turned out to be an auxiliary gasoline tank. I felt so angry because when I looked up, who was dropping this? And there was the American insignia on that plane. And I saw the pilot, and I thought, how dare you do that? Those children are out there. You could have hit some of those children. Why are you dropping that here? And I realized later that that man was trying to tell us something. 2 days later, just about noon, we heard the sound of planes, and we all ran out and we stopped. We were starved for news in all those years. We'd never had one Red Cross package, never any letters from home, never any letters or pamphlets from anywhere. We were just locked inside the barbed wire of that camp. And we looked up, and those planes were coming, double fuselage planes that were painted silver. And they were such a beautiful sight. And all of a sudden, things were dropping out of those planes. And we were yelling. I was screaming, chocolate bars. Look at them. They're chocolate bars. And others said, no, they're canned goods. And others said, I think they're pamphlets. And suddenly, we heard the whistling of the bombs. We knew that we were wrong. And over that little camp of just 2 acres square, they laid over 5,000 incendiary bombs. Just within moments, everything was going up in smoke. I ran to jump into the ditch. And just as my feet hit the bottom of that ditch, the Lord said to me, you borrowed a Bible from that little Chinese woman, Mrs. Lee. I said, that's right, Lord. I have no right to let it burn. My Bible had gone to pieces. I ran inside, I reached up on my rack, I grabbed my Bible, and I came out, and I saw then they had opened the gates, and we started to run. And we ran out of the camp, and when we got outside and across the road, here were machine guns set up, and hundreds of Japanese soldiers, and they just whirled on you with their guns, with their bayonets fixed on them, and they yelled, T-door and you T-door. You just threw yourself out prostrate in the midst of them. And they were running over the top of us, and they were firing at the planes as they went over. And so the planes just circled around and laid another layer of bombs, and then they came back and they began to machine gun us. And I dropped my head onto my arm and I said, God, if anybody's alive at the end of this day, it will be a miracle. And when the last of the planes were gone, the smoke had died down, everything was burned flat. I looked up, and I was alive. And I said, God, once again, I tell you, I have any days left to me, they're all yours. And then I found Mrs. Presswood, and I said, let's go back and see if we can find our cans that we were eating out of and maybe our spoons in the ashes there. When I came back to where Barrack 8 had been, and I saw on the top of the ashes, somehow nobody knew that I had had my bride's book with me. I had sewn it inside of a native mat. And when that barracks had burned, the roof had fallen backwards, the bed had burned and dropped down, the mat had burned away, and somehow the fingers of the wind had just opened it at the center page. And I looked down at it, and there on that beautiful black page was the certificate written in gold ink, my marriage certificate. And I looked down at it, and I said, Lord, that was the only thing I had left. I said, everything else is gone. I said, Lord, couldn't I just have that? And when I reached out to pick it up, the minute my fingers touched it, it disintegrated. It was completely gone. I said, Lord, I don't have anything left. That was the only thing I had. And he said to me, my child, that's what I want to do with you. I want to make you like pure gold, even if I have to take you through the fire 7 times. And I bowed before my Lord, and I said, all right, Lord. I saw that the woman who was head of the barracks next to me was crying, and I went over to her, and I put my arms around her, and I said, don't cry. She said, but my mattress burned. And I said, oh, yes. I said, everything's burned. But I said, we've much to thank God for. We're alive. We're still alive. She said, but I didn't leave that little mattress. It was just a little mat in the barracks. She said, I dragged it out, and I threw it in the ditch where you always lie. And I walked over to the edge of that ditch, and I looked down into it, and there was the casing from the bomb and the ashes of the mattress right where I had been lying. I felt I was in the presence of the Almighty. I said, God, it wasn't Mrs. Lee's Bible, was it, that you wanted me to get? You wanted to get me out of that ditch, wasn't it? And I walked away, and I said, God, for any days I have left, I tell you once more, I'm available. They put us in shacks. They knew that this bombing was coming, and there were shacks up there in the wilderness. And 3 days later, we had a bombing, a shrapnel bomb. And there were those that were killed, children without arms and legs. And one of the young men was from our barracks, and others whose legs had been chopped off by the force of the bomb hitting them. I remember the day when finally, at the end of August 1945, we were called out. And there was Mr. Umaji, and there were the others standing there, all in dress uniform. And they told us that there had been an announcement on the radio by the Imperial Japanese Emperor Hirohito that there was to be a cessation of all fighting.
We hope you are encouraged and inspired by this portion of the testimony of Darlene Rose. As always, don't forget to check out our great weekly specials.